Justin Kibble. Rahul Rumala and Romina Bungro. Thank you so much, everyone. Please go ahead. And thank you, everyone, for staying here all this session.
Okay, check. Can you guys hear me? Okay. Sawadee Kap, Bangkok. Welcome to our talk, our panel. Super excited to be here. Thank you for thank you to Ethereum Foundation, DevCon, for having us. First of all, so we are going to take the next 45 minutes to talk about some of the topics that we feel super passionate about, which is data privacy, user privacy, just users and product in general. So with that, I just want to introduce myself. My name is Rahul. I've been in crypto for a while. I'm currently VP at Safe, leading product engineering. And today we are essentially with these three talented individuals, which I will let them introduce themselves. So first, I hand it off to Romina.
Yeah, hi, Romina Bungert is my name. I'm founder of Erdos Capital. We are an on-chain risk and investment management firm. I've been in the space since 2017 and mostly building on the capital market and institutional side.
All right, hi, everyone. I'm Austin, designer at Dune. We have another designer in the audience here at Dune. Thank you for joining. I've been in the space for a while, been designing in the space since around 2020, and hanging out as a participant before that, so.
And hi, I'm Alice. I'm a data analyst at Safe. I work with the product team to help them understand their users, build features that respond to user needs, and evaluate the impact of new features that we launch. And I've been in the space for about a couple of years, and before that I was working for the UK government with policy designers and also product designers to do exactly the same thing, building for users and citizens.
So are you all ready to talk about users and data and privacy and all that shebang?
Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go. All right. So firstly, I just want to set some context, right? So product discovery, we call this a process, you know, to understand users' problems and using that knowledge to build the product. So in the world of Web3, where things like anonymity and privacy prevail, the question is that how can teams identify user problems, user segments, and collect the right data so to understand their behaviors? So as we, I mean, we heard this a lot today, as we aim to onboard the next billion Web3 users. So the question really becomes, how should we balance building user-centric products in a privacy-centric ecosystem? And with this panel, we hope to accomplish touching on some of those points. So to set the first question, I want to set another context here. It's been 10 years since DevCon Zero, which started in Kreuzberg, Berlin, right, where Romina and I are from, for example. A lot has changed. A lot of new products, a lot of new problems, a lot of new users and opportunities as well. And so it's super nice to see how things have changed and put that into context, right? So kind of like, let's have a little bit of an icebreaker just to kind of get the discussions going, right? So this is a question for all of y'all. What type of a crypto user are you? And what is your current relationship with privacy?
Okay, I can start. So I think I come from more like from the DeFi side, also for my personal uses. So I'm not so much using the social aspects of the projects that have been built, but I, for example, organize my wallets. Like I have one hot wallet that is basically my avatar, or it's connected to my Twitter handle .eth, and this is basically where I hold just like some assets so I can pay with DAI or stables. Just like I always have like 100 or 200 euros in some stable coins, I have some NFTs and maybe also some additional ETH for gas fees. So this is the one that I want to use for non-sensitive interactions. It's also public, right? Like people that know my Twitter name, they can look it up. So I'm aware about that. So for my business activities, I then have a signer just to sign transactions in the companies, for example, with the multi-sig setup. So it always has like a signature deposit. It manages a lot of transactions. They are sensitive. But there are no assets held on this. It's also nice for me to keep my tax accounting overhead low because I can basically do my tax filings just like with one CSV download, and then it's more convenient for me. And then for all the other assets or my portfolio composition, and I have like a dedicated ETH wallet or I have a wallet on another chain, and I basically have a little Excel list to keep an overview of my wallets that are also segregated, and they are also funded sometimes from accounts that are not directly connected to my avatar address. So there is like my personal privacy approach, but it's not a technical solution.
All right, so I think that there's different buckets in the space. I mean, you have your privacy purists, maybe your wallet wanderers who are willing to just connect willy-nilly. And then maybe in the middle, utility seekers. I think I'm a utility seeker, so if I see that I can get some clear value from something, I'm like happy to connect and share. And in general, I think I'm pro-transparency. But also when it comes to kind of financial activity, I guess I was brought up not to really talk about money, so it's strange to initiate a digital conversation with your financial history. So maybe what Romina mentions kind of resonates on that front. I think what really inspired me to get into the space was ownership in the end. I saw that creative people could have ownership. You could have more people on cap tables actually owning parts of projects and businesses. So that's what inspired me to get into the space, but I think there has to be that value exchange. So I'd say I'm a utility seeker. I'm willing to that's kind of my take on privacy. I'm happy to commit information if I understand the value exchange there. So
that's quite well put. I'd say I'm a utility seeker on that point. As a crypto user, I'm probably one of your inactive users. I'm one that puts money in but never takes money out or doesn't actually really engage with all the products that we have out there, just because I still feel like the learning curve is too big to invest and I don't have the patience. So I put money in, I don't take it out, I don't really do transactions. From a privacy point of view, my personal privacy, I feel like I've not really thought about. I feel like I was born in the internet age and I don't really care how people use my data. I just say, that's the world we live in, and I've got to. That's the trade-off I make for the convenience that I get. But as a data analyst, especially coming from government, I care very much about how the company that I work with leverages the data of our users. So I'm very privacy-focused when it comes to our users, not so much my data.
Yeah, that's already super interesting because we have like very different personas of how we use and what type of user you are. So I think this is kind of like an excellent stage for the next question, which I want to ask Romina. As someone who's been in the industry for quite a long time, how do you feel like the uses of our industry has changed over the years, and how has this affected the industry in general?
Yeah, so at the beginning, there was obviously many infrastructure tech for managing our interactions missing. So at the beginning, there was Safe wasn't around yet, right? There was multi-sig solutions have just started to be built. So my first wallet was my Ether wallet. It was very cumbersome. You had to basically write down every step of how you would interact or to keep an overview. So the UX has been massively upgraded. I think we actually also sometimes have better UX for certain aspects when we think about our websites or, you know, like the when we connect our wallets, all that part I find is great. But Yeah, so we saw the shift from a rather developer-focused UX or also the design styles. So some projects you still see that they use font styles like you would have in a coding terminal, or just like they also design their products how a terminal is structured, for example. But you see that less and less, and projects sometimes pivot a bit their UX designs or the flows tailored to their users when they learned more about them over the course of the time. But some projects are also kind of dogmatic and stick to rather cumbersome UX. One that was keeping quite attached to their terrible 90s UX was CurveFi at the beginning. I guess many of you remember. It basically looked like Windows 95. But then there were, for example, NFT minting cream experiences where you could, like, with a mini computer set, like, the features of the NFT or the avatar you wanted to mint, so you could basically set the metadata function, and then the metadata was then giving you, for example, a feature card of the avatar or the persona that you have been minted, and that was amazing. So there have been some great solutions pioneered. Now we just need them to be adopted in the big apps or chains that we are using.
Yeah. So I think that's interesting. And also, like, I remember the last time I was in DevCon Prague, for example, I was building my first company. And I was talking to the users there, you know, like just asking how should we build this. And one of the feedbacks I have received is that if you're building in crypto, you should be building for crypto users first. So let that sink in, right? Like, that was a very maximalist belief back maybe in 2016, 2017. I wouldn't say it's probably like widespread, but it was a very strong belief. So maybe, like, Alice, Austin, you all have been in the industry maybe for 3-4 years, I would say, as a user. How does that perspective make you all feel? Like, how did you all experience the same? Or was it still the same when you entered, and has that changed?
Yeah, sure. I would totally agree with this. I think if you're building for crypto and you want to gain user adoption, then you've got to build things that are built on, say, account abstraction, but without using that term. You know, if you're doing account abstraction the right way, the truth is your user won't know that it's built on account abstraction. They won't even know that it's built on Web3. They might not even know there's digital assets powering it. And we're seeing this with things like Polymarket or WorldCoin. Those are the real apps that are gaining traction and that are actually onboarding users today, but without being, they wouldn't call themselves crypto users or Web3 users necessarily. And it's just unblocking a lot of use cases that you don't see anywhere else.
Yeah, to follow up on that, I think at the beginning, so I've been a participant in the space, I guess, for maybe 7 years, something like that, and then just designing for the past 3 or 4. So I've seen a little bit of the evolution, not like super OG, but I think at first it was this secret club. And the language that we use, I appreciate Romina talking about, like, even the design and the aesthetic. But the language that we use, both the visual language and the written language, was kind of exclusive. Like, we wanted it to be this secret handshake club. I think that's actually fine early on. So when you heard this comment, I think that might have been fine for the time. You know, you were solving super hard problems around, like, decentralization and privacy and cryptography, and now a lot of that is table stakes, and it's time to grow and to, like, communicate not only internally but, like, externally. And the good news, I mean, I have a lot of critiques. Maybe we're not doing this enough, but we are seeing, like, real use cases. Like, my in-law family in Argentina, I mean, they're all over, like, stable coins, and it's very common practice. I just had a friend from Argentina, like, put a down payment on a house using, you know, crypto, and they're like, you know, like exchange locations, you know, because you need to put all the money up front because you don't have, like, sophisticated financing options a lot of times. So it's, you know, I think that we are, like, solving very, at first it was very abstract, but now I think we're solving very core, like, human problems. So stability, for example, like, why do people want stable coins? Well, like, Argentina experienced over 200% inflation. You can't plan for the future, you can't save, you can't, you know, make plans for your family. And so, and it's not about making money, it's just like keeping money, right? And so I think that's why some of the stuff we're making is really taking off. And it's a testament to some of these secret handshakes early on, you know, like some of this like secret club stuff, like they, you know, solving really difficult problems. And now I think we can have more nuanced takes on privacy, for example, with zero knowledge proofs. And, you know, but I think it is time to develop like a more, I guess like a, just a, I just to talk to more people. And that is one thing that I haven't been at Dune for that long, so I can't take credit for the design, but I like that. I feel like they're trying to speak to more people. And there's some other really great projects out there too.
If I can connect to what you just said, you mentioned the users in countries like Argentina, for example, and stablecoin interactions. So here, when we think about, should you cater this dogmatism about, should you cater to crypto native users first? And then, there you have like these certain UX designs that are maybe a bit crypto anarchist inspired, and it's actually intentional, right? And those approaches like cater to crypto natives maybe first was true for projects like Safe, right? For example, Safe has grown and has adopted. By now we have like swap solutions natively integrated. The user doesn't even have to know that he has to look it up on the web on Google, for example, if he wants to trade on CowSwap. He will get it selected or in an interface nicely presented in Safe. But there are also use cases like when we want to cater to these people in emerging markets where some solutions didn't work, and now Celo, for example, has great traction with catering crypto users, and these are basically telephone or mobile phone users that get a crypto wallet spun up connected to their telephone that they have or their mobile device. And they're not even aware that they're using the blockchain. So there's this partnership, MiniPay, together with Oprah, and I think these are great designs. So it's a very different approach than catering to crypto-native users first and then learn and adopt. So depending on what your use case is, your approach could look very different. So knowing your user well or like where your solution has the high impact, I think should, give you the orientation on which approach you follow.
I thought the quote said the opposite. I thought you said, if you want to build for crypto, you should not build for crypto users,
no.
Which is what I believe is what we should do.
That's true.
So I think it's about knowing your users, but it's also about knowing your potential users, right? Because if we just rehash what do we know about our Web3 users today and what are they doing and how are they interacting on chain, we're missing all the other aspect, and then, you know, not even thinking about what are the users that are not currently on chain doing and what is the purpose for bringing them on chain.
So that's an interesting segue, right? Like knowing the users and knowing what the users want. Like if I can throw in this very age-old adage by Henry Ford, you know, if I asked my customers what they want, they would have asked for faster horses. Right. So I think we're in this industry where the user is a wallet. Wallet is almost an identity, and that identity does not have like something like an email or a persona, for example. So I think when building for this user, how can we as builders effectively collect data, or what patterns we can observe to actually solve problems? Like, what are the actual problems rather than shipping out features left and right, right? And I think I would start with Austin here, kind of like, because you spend a lot of time of your day building, talking to users and building for users. So how do you go about it then?
Yeah, just to start, I think the Ford Foundation can't confirm this quote. But I think they said something like, that's something like he would have said, so we can all make a tacit agreement that he said it. And I think in this case, the key is to try to find the subtext, you know, when someone tells you they're having a problem or they want a product or a feature request. In this case, it would be like they want to go faster, right? People are experts in their problems and the challenges they face, but not necessarily in how to solve them. And so... Yeah, I think that it's uncovering the fundamental human need. And there aren't actually that many. You know, as I mentioned earlier, I think sometimes people want stability. They want their time back. They want money. They want rewards of the tribe. So, you know, social affirmation from the people around them. They might enjoy the reward of the hunt, you know. Like, for example, I know, like, the analysts on Dune are, I think, enjoy the hunt. I think they want to find that insight. And there's also an element of self-mastery, you know, like, let's see what I can create. But it's really, I don't think there are that many fundamental human needs. So I think it's trying to be clear, you know, not talk about the features necessarily that we're shipping all the time. And we could, as designers, I could get better at this, and everyone could get better at this, just like tying this to like a really core fundamental need. I think we don't because it sounds too simple. But I think sometimes there's a sophistication in simple.
There's a bunch of different things you could do. So one thing with the data is always to marry quantitative with qualitative. So I do a lot of the quant stuff. I've done qual stuff in the past, but we've got some lovely people at Safe who do it very well. But it's understanding how people are using your tool from the data, but then going and asking them. And there's a lot of techniques you can use, you know. Why? You ask five times why. So you say you need this. Why do you need it? And then you ask that five times, and you'll realize that the fifth answer is so completely different to what they said initially. Because people tend to think, I want this, and they tend to think about the feature that they want rather than the problem they're trying to solve with that feature. And you, as the engineer, as the dev, you're better placed to understand kind of how to technically answer that need that someone without the context of how your product is built can. But I face the same thing with data, you know. I'm surrounded by people who say, I want this metric. And if you ask them, why do you want this metric? It's to measure an outcome. And I realize that the metric they actually want doesn't quite match the outcome. It's about, well, if you want to measure that outcome, I suggest we track this or that metric. And it's always coming back to, as an expert, it's about being able to realize you're the expert in the room and trying to understand from your users what they really need. And I have to say, like, in Web3, we're still such a small space that we can go out to users. Users want our products to grow. They've adopted our products, and they want to keep them, you know, evolving. And we should leverage that relationship that we have, that in Web2, it's really hard to do, you know. Here people want to help you out, you know, and they want to see, have a better experience using your product going forward. So let's leverage that as well.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, and to that point, I mean, I completely agree. I think a lot of times in the research space, there's this battle between the qualitative feedback people and the quantitative feedback people. Either they're wired that way or that's where their skill set is. But I think that they tell different parts of the story. So, you know, you have, I think the quantitative is really good at telling you what's happening and observing actual behavior, because a lot of times people don't tell you or they're not even aware of their actual behavior. But then you can follow that up with, you know, conversations or observing the space. And this doesn't always have to be like formal, long form interviews. I think we do a pretty good job right now just by, you know, I'm trying to do this more, engage on Twitter or in Telegram groups and get, it's not just one conversation, it's kind of a relationship, and you can get that kind of like ambient signal and then see, is there any discrepancy between that and like the actual behavior or the data? And maybe there's like something interesting there, like something that's worth exploring.
Yeah, I think what you described, how you approach like pulling data and getting like an overview of different crypto interactions is what we can already track about them on chain, but there are also some parts of the user flow or flow of funds that we might not see yet. So from when we look at the capital markets industry, it's very common that for very big trades, when we think about ETFs or large funds, when a rebalancing happens or someone basically dissolves a position, those trades are not made like in the public market, but because they have the potential to move the market, so they are then fractionalized and traded away in, for example, dark pools where there's like like an OTC, so an off-chain matching, about like where the buy and the sell side agree on a price, and then it gets basically cleared and traded and settled and so on. So those type of more institutional use cases, and they are still done in the centralized exchange context, because here we have rather a logic like we know them from stock markets and bond markets and so on. So there are some data points that we don't see yet. So it's really important to know the user and the ultimate goal where he wants to, but sometimes our technology also has advantages where the user doesn't know what feature he wants because he doesn't really know that this is a problem that's already solvable and you have to pioneer the technology. So this is where we still have some frictions and it makes sense to pay attention, also have like user interviews often and not only do the data analytics.
So I have a question on, you mentioned like a use case of rebalancing portfolios, right? So if I remember correctly, this is like, there are programmable solutions out there that'll automate rebalancing of portfolios, right? So essentially these are, I guess you can call them bots. You know, and when you look at, like, from a data angle, when you look at activity, on-chain transactional activity, are we seeing essentially bots as real users? Are we an industry where bots are legitimate users?
It depends. My answer is always, it depends. It depends on what you're trying to measure, right? So I read a stat the other day. I think ChatGPT gave me that stat. But 50% of internet activity is bots. So I think it's no lower in crypto, it's probably higher. If they're airdrop farmers and you're trying to measure real adoption of your chain and they're just farming for your chain's airdrop, then you probably don't want to see them as real users. But if they're active traders who are actively using your DeFi protocol and are making 60% of the volume, I'd say they probably are active users. They're generating the volume that you're getting fees from, or that you're, you know, they are generating real activity, they are powered by humans at the end of the day, who are using your protocol actively in comparison to another DeFi protocol to make money.
You want to add?
Yeah, maybe connecting to what you said with the bots and that they are probably also a higher amount in our industry. And when we think about airdrop farming, also hamster, like maybe some of you saw the presentation earlier, Ton, I mean, the technical approach to it is really powerful, I think. And abstracting gas fees or have payment master accounts like has a great potential for more the average users. But in the trading space, for example, here we have also like some very granular differences when we, for example, look at the amount of accounts, right? Ton showed us these accounts numbers, but or wallet numbers that have been spun up in Telegram. But actually, like I use this to farm or hamster the airdrop, or I gave it to my daughter when she had like too much energy. But then after 3 days, we forgot about it, and since then it's like a dead account. So I think that's still like part of that. But there are also some bot or trading activity that has like very different logic. And where it's powerful, for example, like in, from the trading side, and I think the financial side is still like one of the most relevant when we think about a blockchain, like the impact that blockchain can have for the users that don't have access yet. So here I can also talk more and more, but I don't want to take up more space. Yeah,
the question is really how. What's the quality of that user? Whether it's a human or a bot, it doesn't really matter. What's the quality and what's the kind of long-term quality of that user?
You mentioned, I mean, it's interesting, actually. It's kind of going to the topic where I wanted to also highlight, which is definition of active user in Web3, where, you know, identity is so fragmented in our space. We use accounts like almost like avatars, right? So what is the current definition of an active user? And I'm kind of curious how, from a quantitative side, how you look at it, and from a qualitative side, how Austin would probably look at it, and as a user, perhaps, you know, how Romina would have that perspective of categorization.
You're opening a can of worms. I don't know who was at DuneCon yesterday, but I think every other talk was talking about how it's very difficult to measure active users, how this measure is flawed, etc. I think, again, it depends on your project. So we're not just measuring things. We're trying to understand, measure outcomes, measure the success of a particular product, of a particular feature. So an active user can mean very different things for different protocols, you know? So Safe started off, for example, as a self-custody multi-sig solution. It's the safest smart contract out there to save your, to keep your funds. The way we could have measured active users 4 or 5 years ago was how many users are depositing funds, storing value in safes, you know? Now we're trying to get, with the world evolving and smart accounts becoming more prominent, we're trying to bring activity led by smart accounts and not just EOA. So what's important to us is how many users are actually using those funds that they deposited on safes a while back. So an active user that could have been just a user depositing funds now becomes an user that is actually using those funds and transacting volume, right? So it really depends on your product, and you have to think about what definition makes sense in that context.
I also have like a bunch of user groups in mind or how I break them down. So I think when we start with the crypto natives, we would have the whales, or we would have the degens that ape. We would have the crypto curious that take the time and get involved, but it's not like they're doing a lot or have like a lot of funds that they are gambling around with. And then we have like, the, for example, the emerging market user that does, that uses it for remittance or also for wealth creating products. So here just like stablecoin adoption or whatever. So yes, these are probably also single wallets, or here we can trace like wallet interactions. But when we think about like capital markets, then a wallet is not a user. So I would be careful to always to generalize that a wallet is always equivalent to a user, because we have sub-account logics, right? Where like accounts execute certain strategies, or it's a vault or whatever, and the user is not the wallet, but it's like on a very different aggregation level. And yeah, I think like when we think about and the numbers of, for example, the speed of transaction, right? Like which infrastructure or route are they taking through like the trades? It's very different. For example, high frequency trading would also need to use very different combinations of chain, or would have also cross-chain or multi-chain complexities. They are much easier for like, let's say, investors, value investors that hold positions and have sometimes like a trade. And here it's, more about abstracting probably like the general key management, the chain management, and so I see like very different angles.
A lot of what you actually shared as a user, these tend to be like off-chain interactions or workflows. No. This is actually, some can be on-chain as well, but like I guess a lot of it.
I just want all on-chain examples. I'll try to give,
But did you, like...
Or not financial institutions, I didn't explicitly describe that, because they also have wallets and need certain user functionalities, and here we have a big impact.
For Safe, for example, there's a lot of off-chain activity of like collecting, approving signatures, which means that the users are actually interacting with your app. And there is just one simple use case, right? And when we spoke about quantitative data, qualitative data, a lot of the industry reports tend to focus or overly focus on like on-chain activity as like...
These are workflows, in organizations where like wallets are already used. So I think like they're... So Safe is one approach, right? Just like a multi-sig approach, and there it already has like the permission management, but then there's also other wallets or basically signature tools like Fireblocks, right? We have like MPC and privacy technology here, also security technology that helps to abstract key management, but also allows for like building an interface, and then you have like different permissions for depending on which user or what they can see, you know, that they don't see all the data or not, or you can have randomizers over certain wallets so that, like, if an exchange in the category of a financial institution, for example, that people that send funds to a wallet that is owned by a centralized exchange, they wouldn't be able to trace, like, all the other wallets of a centralized exchange, right? So.
And I think I want to like get some of Austin's perspective, so I just want to shift focus a little bit. Just compared to Web2, right? Like we're talking about off-chain, on-chain. Like, what are some like trade-offs that you feel like we make in Web3 that differ from Web2 in terms of like general practices?
Oh man, I had a really good answer to the last question. You'll have to come to my next panel. So some trade-offs. I think, as I mentioned earlier, we've been optimizing for like solving very fundamental problems around like decentralization and autonomy. And you know, like I said, I think those are table stakes now. And we have to start thinking about maybe until we really improve the kind of Web3 experience to like, exceeds the Web2 experience, we have to think about how we can use those moments. So for example, like, you know, how can we alter our language to speak to people more clearly? How can we communicate? You know, we talked about, are you a privacy purist or kind of, you know, a wallet wanderer or more of a utility seeker? I think copy is actually really important, like to communicate the message. I think a lot of times we put tons of information in the documentation or in the T's and C's. And this is something a lot of times teams don't have copywriters. And it's something that I think a lot of designers reluctantly do. But it's worth taking the time, and this is a pain point, you know, for me, to really communicate clearly the exchange. Like, what are you getting and what are you giving? Especially if you want to onboard more people. I think that's super important. And then just things like, you know, transactions taking a lot of time, you know, these sorts of things. Like, until we fix that, we have to think about those as opportunities to, you know, educate or entertain or engage. There are lots of little moments like that that are slightly different in Web3, but ideally we just solve that. And we can move on to, you know, creating next level experiences, and we're not trying to like fill these moments with fixes.
I think I just want to, like, as we are nearing, probably, like, we got, like, 8 minutes left, and I wanted to kind of shift focus, maybe, like, the future outlook of our industry. The question to all of y'all, preferably, is looking ahead, like, how can the Web3 industry onboard, like, a diverse user base without compromising user privacy? Are there emerging tools or practices, frameworks that you feel you're excited about?
Maybe I can connect to one of the examples I gave earlier that was around signature management, so solutions like Fireblocks, MPC technology, or CKKYC, like MENA protocol, or a few other projects are working on, basically verifying that you're, like, for example, allowed, that you're on the allowed list to use a certain service without sharing your private data. And that can be like, yes, from exams from the financial world, but it could also be related to health data and so on, where it's really sensitive data that should not get access to other people. So with MPC, you would, for example, expose that data. You would not expose the data, you would conceal that data, but for example, MPCs, you would always have like, part of the secret would always be held by the MPC technology provider. But FHE, for example, fully homomorphic encryption, is basically where you can see or the data and also verify it in a in a bit more complex technical way.
I'd probably challenge this a little bit. I don't think the way to get towards privacy is to give a third party
exactly.
access.
That's why you have to choose different types of privacy technologies depending on the use case. That's what I was trying to to highlight here.
That makes sense.
And I think like there's this part of what type of data is interacted and what is the right approach to secure privacy. And it could be, for example, we don't want to interact with criminals or to have exposure to tainted funds, or that, for example, our insurances would know like what we have genetic, more likelihood that we get like a certain deathly disease. But there's also more like the surveillance state type of data that many people have in mind. So.
I think we operate in a little bit of a tricky place because we started, well, blockchain ethos kind of started as privacy preserving. That quickly went away when, you know, you had all these tools that are coming in where you can follow the history of all the different wallets and what they do on chain and how they connect to each other. And you've seen, you know, authorities get using that data to ban certain activity or to ban certain wallets. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying the truth is everything's on chain. Everything is available, and tools like Dune are making that data even more digestible. So we have to think about, I think we're at crossroads. We have to think about how we use data and how, because the truth is companies, organizations are always going to want to know more about their users because they want to grow, because they want to maximize profits, because whatever reason it is, they are going to want to know more and they're going to leverage this on-chain data. Is it okay? Is it okay that we're able to track a whole transaction history and base our product on this? Is it okay that we're able to connect a wallet to an identity because someone's doxed it or put that information on-chain, online, sorry? And is it also, you know, what kind of product tracking are we putting in place that's not on chain, that's like proprietary data? And we need to think about how we do that as well. Are we always GDPR compliant? You know, are we, when we match the data we collect off chain to some data that we might collect on chain, are we doing it in a way that is privacy preserving for our users? And most importantly, are our users totally aware of what, you know, they're signing in the TNCs, it's what you were saying earlier, and what they're giving away for the usability of the product?
I think that would be relevant in permission setups, right? But if you have permissionless setups, maybe like being compliant to a current already outdated GDPR directive is maybe not like what you should orientate yourself about. So let's think about a second example. That would be transfer rules for financial institutions, where basically for every crypto transactions, and we don't have that in the fiat system, a financial institution would have to store collect the data of the sender, the recipients, their identification, the source of funds, or whatsoever. It's like a very poor requirement and technologies that they have been adopting, where we already have like really impactful solutions in the crypto space that could protect also users that haven't been anticipated yet, or technologies in GDPR. And
awesome.
Let's see. So I think that Web 2 has, and the internet in general, has proven that people are not that concerned about their privacy, for better or worse. But I do think, counter to that, we're given a lot of data and a lot of information. Sometimes it feels like, it can be a blessing or a curse. I think sometimes we have a hard time finding the signal in that data, which can be a real challenge, something we're working on. But I think it's not so, I don't think we need to make decisions for people. I just think we need to communicate clearly. You know, what is it that you're giving? What is it that you're getting? For example, I'm not transactional when it comes to my friends or my family or my community. But if I'm engaging with, you know, a government, if I'm paying taxes, or if I'm, you know, getting a subscription with a company, like, I want to know, like, what am I giving and what am I getting? And I think we be as clear as possible about that and the design and the product and let people make decisions for themselves. And obviously there'll be a parallel, you know, government conversation. I assume someone's handling, you know, compliance. That's, you know, they'll usually tell us. So, yeah.
So I want to have one last round of like a lightning round of questions. So if you had a magic wand and you could ask for any feature as a user in Web3, what would that be?
Okay. Connecting to my most recent painful experience, I would like to have like an account that abstract the gas fees and allows me for multi-chain interactions when I, for example, want to do a multi-chain bridging of funds and trades, or having pool assets from different chains, for example, something from the Polkadot environment where this is not where it's even more painful than Ethereum.
So at the moment, we're working on integrating AI more into kind of the data analyst workflow at Dune. And unexpectedly, I found that really powerful personally. I'm relatively new to the space, you know, trying to learn SQL. But being able to kind of have this conversation, it's really like an education. You can see the diff on the left and the right. And so I think more of that. Right now, we had this kind of past year of you know, an explosion of AI, but like using it like intelligently, like where people already are, I think is could be a lot of fun. It could be really useful.
Probably wishful thinking, but I'd like one place where I can interact with all crypto, Web3 stuff, like all my balances in one place, being able to use all my funds, and one place that I trust. And I can self-custody my funds in a secure way.
I agree as well. I think as we mature as a user and industry, I think we converge to having simplicity, essentially. With that, we're a minute over time. That concludes our panel. Thank you to Romina, Austin, and Alice. Thanks for sharing all the information. Really helped.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Raul.
We have Q&A, I think. Yeah.
That was an amazing panel. Thank you, everyone. Please don't forget to scan the QR code so you can write your questions in the app, so we can follow up with some questions for the panel here. So please, we are going to have a minute to have that. So please. Because we ran out of microphones, so we need to do it from here. So please go ahead. We have plenty of time for questions, so please go ahead with the QR code.
The awkward silence.
No, I think there are no questions. People have already left, and the next ones are waiting for.
Do we have one question? Is it? Yeah, there is a question. So.
Oh. Maybe we can pass microphone. That's yes. More user friendly.
It has to be through technology.
Okay. Then maybe we have to go to that person with the microphone.
You can come ask your question on stage.
Do you want to yell out your question? Nice.
Thanks, Romina.
Okay, thank you. So I want to ask about that. You said that sometimes when we talk to user, we should define the thing that user does not know what he really want for. So how to track the thing that the user does not really know about when you develop a product. And I have another question. Is that true that the first step when you develop your product is to ask your customer, or we need to find some prior step for example, analyzing the market or something like that? So that's all of my two questions.
I think the first question summary, if correct me if I'm wrong, is more about like how do we know what the user actually says what they want versus what they actually need, right? How do we get to the need versus rather than what they are asking for, essentially? If I'm correct,
Yeah. The unhelpful answer is it depends, but I think if you have to pick like a particular playbook, start with a hypothesis or a particular question that you want to answer. Dig into the quantitative data if you have it, and even if you haven't started a project yet, you know, it's a lot of data on chain. Like, you can probably go out there and find some signal, and then try to understand what's happening, and then follow up, you know, with maybe build something and get some feedback. Or if you feel like you really need to discover, you know, you can follow up and go talk to people and try to follow up, answer that question essentially. But you might have some.
No, that's a good point. Maybe just adding on this, if you are actually talking to a user, if they are making a feature request, then that's probably a signal that that's already too narrow and too precise. Like, try to understand why do they need that feature. And then you might agree that that feature is indeed what responds to their need, or you might disagree and think that another feature or a different, the feature built in a slightly different way might respond to their need better.
Yeah,
maybe to make it more, clear with a specific example. So this multi-chain feature, multi-chain trading, right? Like, I had to write for every step of my trade. It was just, I actually just wanted to leave a position. It was stables versus like a certain token. And for every little step of on-chain interaction, I had to write a support request. But my actual goal was to just like swap USDC and a token from a different chain. And it had like 10 steps involved that I couldn't navigate through because there was no help text or so on that website.
Yeah, I think it's just nailing down on that is getting to the root cause and not focusing on the symptom is like, why are they trying to do something? And really drill them to the point that they actually disclose the problem they're trying to solve, not the feature that they're trying to use, essentially. I didn't quite catch your second question, but perhaps we can catch after and then maybe discuss that. All right.
There's one for you, Austin.
We have one question. we have someone with the microphone waiting. And after your question, we'll go with the questions here in the screen.
Well, actually, it's not that I had a question and I lost the momentum, but I had a comment about the pause between you asking us for a question and silence. So I scanned this code, it asked me to enter some wallet, I clicked the button, it asked me to do something, I'm like, no, I'm not that interested in this one. So actually I have answer to the question that was asked, because I'm always triggered as a person responsible for a product. I'm always triggered with the quote from Henry Ford about, if I asked people what they need, they will tell me they need a faster horse. The answer to this one is simple. You do not ask people what they want. You ask people what problems they have, what they do on daily basis. And then it's your job to figure out the way to solve their problems. And then you present some prototype to them. If it sticks, you did your job well. So, yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was awesome. So we have three questions here. So, to what extent will AI impact the role of designers in the future?
Oh, hot topic. I'm personally excited about it. I mean, we're on this ride, so like you might as well enjoy the ride. and anecdotally, I've seen it be really powerful. Like, there's a ton of things that we're doing as designers, which is really tedious and you know, annoying. And I think in the short term, you know, like, if it's integrated into workflows intelligently, I haven't seen this in design yet very effectively. You know, Figma launched a bunch of AI features recently, and it hasn't really been sticky in my workflow. Like, maybe I need to be more aggressive about, you know, changing my habits. Just like learning shortcuts, you kind of have to brute force your way into like new habits when it comes to something you do, you know, 10 hours a day. But yeah, so far it's a playground. I see it as an opportunity. I haven't, aside from, you know, the classic just ChatGPT, a conversation partner to explore topics and ideas. Actually, that's been really powerful. Just to be like, hey, I need an icon for this. Like, give me 10 ideas. You know, like, because a lot of times you have to create choices before you make choices as a designer. But unfortunately, often it's just you staring at your screen. And so to have like that brainstorming partner, at least at the moment, I mean, that's been the main way it's affected my workflow for now. In a positive way. And yeah, I'd say like it's happening, we're along for the ride. I'm generally optimistic about it.
Awesome. We have time for one more question from what is written here. I'm trying to choose the right one.
And we have one more here.
Sorry, that's my question.
Okay.
Sorry, I was trying to put a new line and it actually posted the question. My question is like, when you are trying to develop a B2B application and other, the party, the business is not working in a Web3 space, what is the best way to onboard such business users?
So maybe I can give an example where the solution would basically combine two different chains. So for example, a friend of mine has developed AI agents for Web2 users, or, you know, like from that world. And basically the approach was to combine a near-based approach, so where it's basically abstracting a bit more designed for Web2 users in mind. And then basically there was like a bridge in, or basically interactions with Ethereum or EVM compatibility. So navigating Ethereum was actually not so relevant. Everything that this B2B Web2 user was experiencing was pretty much like the same UX as he would have in the Web2 logic. So there are many solutions to different problems.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Please give a great applause to this panel today. Appreciate it.